Good evening and welcome to Late Night in the Midlands. I'm Michael Vera and this broadcast is coming at you live from the east coast of the United States, the capital city, Columbia, South Carolina. And again, I want to welcome you all wherever it is you may be around the globe, in the chat room, maybe on some phone lines, wherever you are. Thanks for joining us. Another good one tonight, I think. But first, the website, www.latenightinthemidlands.com. Go on over, become a member, and be informed. But by all means, inform others. And folks, if you can help us out, please help us out. You know, we have to hop over a lot of hurdles, it seems, each month. New challenges come to us, and we're being challenged again. So help us out and help keep us on the air. You could donate. We got donate buttons on the main page of latenightinthemidlands.com. And we also have them on the chat and listen page as well. So help us out if you can. Subscribe. That helps us stay on the air as well. Subscriptions and share the information around. The more, the merrier. It's all about waking them up, right? And the call-in number, 803-317-2264 when we start taking calls. And our guest tonight is John DiNardo, and I want to tell you a little bit. I mean, he's been on this show several times before, and I guess I don't have it. See, I'm having this is another night where somehow, mysteriously, the bio for my guest has disappeared here. But, okay. But anyways, John DiNardo, he's got one hell of a background. He's been on this show before, and I'll let him give it to you. Probably be easier than me digging around trying to find it and then wind up knocking myself off the air here. So, we'll let John DiNardo tell you more about, his background. But, he has a substantial background, and he's definitely got one that would possibly back up a lot of what he says. Now, he's going to talk about Planet X, and I know that's a controversial-type topic. Even with me, it is. It's one of those things where there's proof for it. There's good arguments against it. And, you know, some of us are just stuck in the middle, unsure. But I think that we can all agree that there are lots of changes going on around the world and even in our solar system. And, well, we'll be talking about those tonight with John DiNardo. Japan, for instance, I guess near Japan, a new island has rose. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But let me get into some of this news, get to the break, and then we'll get John DiNardo on here. And he's got a lot to tell us. And, you know, I had asked him about Comet Ison and these other comets that are drifting our way. And he says they are all the result. All these objects we see being flung through space are a result of Planet X. Are they? I don't know. I can't prove they are. He says he can, though. But I can't prove they're not either. All right. Well, hey, Homer Simpson would be proud, they say. Nuclear regulators crack firewalls to access porn. Yeah, that's right. That's what they're doing. So while radiation is leaking and the world is going to hell in a handbasket, these guys are watching porn. It becomes tougher to surf porn on government computers after scandals, but some workers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission managed to find ways to bypass detection software and firewalls to get the content, records have shown. One contract employee watched, in his words, two porn-type Netflix movies during downtime. I didn't know Netflix had porno movies. Anyways, on his 12-hour shift at the commission's office, of Information Services. Another employee repeatedly used the photo sharing site Flickr to search for pornography while at the office. And for years, a resident inspector at the agency scoured eBay looking for pornographic images. So I guess they're trying to get around it by finding it, you know, because these sickos, they got this stuff linked up everywhere. They'll even embed it in your computer without you knowing it, a lot of these sites. But anyways, in six cases that the Times inquired about, the agency proposed disciplinary penalties ranging from a three-day suspension to removal from the job. So rather than regulate, so we really got Homer Simpsons in these nuclear facilities who, you know, just want to sit there, eat donuts, drink coffee, and watch porn, and hope that nothing goes wrong. How safe are you feeling? ISON unfolds its wings, a story linked up under News and Discoveries on the homepage of LateNightInTheMidlands.com. You might want to go check it out when you get a chance. Says second huge outburst approaches X-flare fragments break off the nucleus. And there are some videos there and a nice little article, and I was checking it out today, so I thought I'd share it with you. And again, we'll talk more about that with John DiNardo. List of high-ranking military officers purged by Obama. And wow, folks, I'll tell you, what a list. Check it out. I checked out this article today, and I mean, the list, it seemed like it never ended. The list just kept going. As a matter of fact, at the bottom, there's a link where the list had broke off. You have to go to that link to actually see them all. I mean, there's that many. Barack Hussein Obama is purging our military of possible dissenters. At least that's one theory. Certainly one of mine. If you were to believe the mainstream media, a good chunk of these guys are scum, involved in everything from selling secrets to whores to gambling. And I would say if that's the case, they're probably fit right in with our government, because that pretty much explains most of them. And so, yeah, you need to check out this list of all these high-ranking military officers who have been fired. And it's my understanding that some of them were fired for stopping South Carolina from getting nuked. I mean, my God, horrible people they are. Oh, New Island forms near Japan. Oh, this is what I was just talking about. A new island has formed near Japan and may be another sign of Earth's changes, prophesized by Edgar Cayce and others many years ago. The Earth changes continue across our wonderful planet. The second island, I believe this is now, that has popped up from the depths of the ocean. I think the other one was off of Indonesia, I think, if I remember correctly. So now we got these new islands popping out. And no, it's not unusual. It's certainly unusual to have two within a few months' time period, I think. So a lot of activity, a lot of changes. And, you know, some of those prophecies talk about how mountains will fall and new ones will rise. Yeah, not to wonder. You just got to wonder. Hawaii's Big Island bans biotech companies, GMO crops. The Governing Council for Hawaii on the Big Island Tuesday banned biotech companies from operating on their island while barring growth of genetically modified organisms. And good for them. The Hawaii County Council approved Bill 113 by a vote of 6-3, which would mandate a possible 30 days in jail and up to a $1,000 fine for any violator of the ban on growing genetically modified organisms, that is GMOs, on the Big Island. Officially known as Hawaii Island, the largest and southernmost of the Hawaiian state, the bill also keeps out biotech giants like Monsanto, Dow, and BASF, which have operations on other Hawaiian islands. let's see, one of them is Kauai recently advanced its own legislation that increases regulation of biotech companies there. You know, we need to do this all around the country and just kick them all out. Get rid of them all. They're no good. They're worthless. And they're killing not only the planet, they're killing us. Police taser, 14-year-old in handcuffs for his own good. So here we have another one of those stories, right? You got to see the picture, too. I mean, this kid looks like five grown men beat the crap out of him. The story is titled Take the Police Out of the Police State on the homepage of LateNightInTheMidlands.com. And when you click on that link, it takes you over, and there's some different scenarios and cases that are going on right now. And one of them that caught my eye, police taser, 14-year-old in handcuffs, and it was for his own good. And yet another Pennsylvania police brutality case. A mother is threatening to sue after officers tasered her 14-year-old son in the face. They tased him in the face while he was handcuffed. The mom, Marissa Sergeant, showed WCAU-TV a set of stunning photos of what the boy's face looked like after he was arrested for shoplifting at Walmart. The mother condemns the shoplifting, but legitimately feels that the police went way too far. Hell yeah, they went too far. I thought we've gotten away from the times of when somebody stole something, you cut their hands off. Or if somebody ran from authority, you cut their feet off. I thought we got by that, burning witches at the stake. Didn't we get by all that? I thought we did. I could be mistaken. So this kid, you know, steal something at Walmart. And I know there's going to be some idiots out there that say, well, that's what he gets for stealing, right? Well, you know what? Face it. In your lifetime, every single one of you, nobody, I don't care who you are, can say that at some time in your life, you did not take something that didn't belong to you. Everybody has done it. That even includes if you're, say, working for a company like, say, Kodak. And, you know, they're notorious for throwing thousands of cameras out, you know, and they have to go to the garbage. Nobody's allowed to touch them. They have to be thrown out, but they're good. And, you know, workers will sometimes say, well, I throw that out. I'm taking it home with me, right? So you justify stealing, basically. So everybody, I don't care who you are, have taken something at some point in your life that did not belong to you. So, you know, to tase a 14-year-old boy in the face and beat on him, I mean, because this kid clearly looks beat up. Apparently, he's handcuffed. They tase him, and he falls flat on his face on the concrete. You know, it's just uncalled for, absolutely uncalled for, and they did go too far. Wait, if that was my son, why would I? I mean, this is not my son, and I'm pissed. In a display of stunning wisdom befitting the intelligence of a man with a law degree, Bucks County District Attorney David Heckler, perfect name, said Tully Town officers fired a taser and hit the boy in the face as he was escaping. Oh, he was escaping. He wasn't running. He was escaping from their police cruiser and began to flee. The district attorney went on to say that the 14-year-old was not able to stop his face from hitting the pavement because he was handcuffed, thus causing the bruising seen in the photos. Heckler went on to say that the officers were forced to use the taser on the child because they were fearing for his safety. No, they were forced to use the taser because their fat, donut-eating, lazy asses can't catch nobody. They're too used to their radios and their cars. I'm sorry. Now, look, I know there's some good cops out there. I do. I know there are. Okay? But I keep getting stories like this, and it really irritates me. How are you forced to tase a 14-year-old boy in handcuffs? Really? How far was he going? Was he going to hop a few fences without his hands? You couldn't catch him? Now, come on. These cops must have had one donut too many if they could not run down a 14-year-old boy in handcuffs. However, the mother, who, unlike the district attorney, has an IQ higher than a room temperature, and she is not buying the heckler narrative. The mother questioned how, if her son was running away, that they could have been tasing him in the face. The mom believes that the police officers beat her son and then frightened him into not telling. And that's most likely exactly what happened. I mean, come on. So he's running away from you, but you tased him in the face. They got boomerang tasers. Now they could swing them out and they'll come back and hit you in the face. Unbelievable. Okay, moving along here. Oh, and I got something I'm kind of looking forward to getting to here in a second. But first, ABC News actually did a story, and it was titled West Coast Evacuation Due to Fukushima Radiation. An interesting video, again, linked up on Late Night in the Midlands homepage. The fake news is starting to pick this up. While it is shocking, it is also hard to cover up any longer. So they're really being forced. Yet, you know, they are. They're being forced, but yet do not be fooled when they spew lies like the radiation is being diluted in the ocean, so it will not be so bad. That's a bunch of BS. Yeah, there is some dilution, but any amount of radiation is bad, in my opinion. I think a lot of you would agree. Radiation is bad and it kills, and you do not want any level of contact if you can help it. So, you know, by them lying, they just endanger people more. But they're at least they're starting to report on it now at a local level. I haven't seen, you know, the big ones talking about it much, but I have seen the some of these little local outfits talking about it. But again, you know, they're telling you, well, they're getting people on there who are saying, oh, yeah, the water will dilute it. And you got nothing to worry about. And that's why we got dolphins coming up on shore looking like they've been cooked on a rotary for 24 hours because, you know, it's all safe out there. So anyways, Fukushima, you know, it's really it's what's coming. Which is the worst is yet to come. You know, there's still a lot going on there, and that place is a time bomb waiting to go off. And, you know, starts collapsing, you know, those fuel rods and all. I don't know. You know. Good luck. That's all I could say to all of us. Oh, remember the other night I was talking about this new little game that the teens are playing out on the street. Teens playing the knockout game. Well, remember how I said that they're going to end up trying to knock out the wrong person? Well, it happened. Team playing knockout game gets shot twice by intended victim, and then he's jailed. So he's lucky enough that he lived to be jailed. The story of something called the knockout game, where inner city teens will randomly attack helpless and innocent men and women by blindsiding them with a sucker punch. The results are dramatic and terrifying. Major news networks all across the country are running it to warn people to keep a sharp eye out. Well, I don't think that's the only reason they're running it. I think they're also running it to try to get racial tensions going, you know, in any way that they can, because they claim that it's black kids who are running up and attacking white men and women. Now, I'm willing to bet that there's more than just black kids doing it, but I don't know. But anyways, I think that's probably one of the reasons they're running it, because they love this stuff. The mainstream media, they thrive on this stuff. Anyways, when walking alone on city streets, you'll get these thugs who will run up and try to take one good punch at you and knock you out. And sometimes when these people are down on the ground, you know, him and his buddies will just keep kicking them and beating on them. Anyways, oh, there's a new wrinkle in this whole story and in this game. One that should strike fear into the heart of these little teen thugs who think they're manly men because they can run up to somebody who's unexpected and punch them and knock them out, and doing this to women, no less. That's a clear sign that they don't have any kind of structure in the home. Not any at all. Probably no father in the home. And mom's probably working two jobs and going to the bar at night or smoking crack or something. I mean, because these kids obviously have no structure. The people are not just fighting back. They're shooting back. The video linked up on the homepage. You'll see that link. Click on it. And, well, it took place at Lansing, Michigan, where a teen attempted to tase an unexpected man waiting to pick up his daughter at a school bus stop. And apparently tasing is a new addition to the knockout game. When Marvell Weaver approached the father to tase him, he had no idea that his intended victim was legally carrying a handgun for self-defense. When the attempted hit failed, the father simply pulled out the fully registered legal handgun that Obama wants to take from you and calmly shot Weaver twice. Weaver was then imprisoned, given a trial, and pled guilty to his crime. The knockout game is a cruel and cowardly way to attack innocent people, but gamers, be warned, people are not just fighting back. They're shooting back as well. And I got to say, good for that man. And, you know, if it was me, I would have done the same thing. The same thing. And, it, you know, and it's a shame that some kid has to get shot. It really is. It's a shame. But what do you expect? You know, if you're not going to teach your kids a lesson in the home and teach them how to be men and women and teach them how to act in society, then what you're going to get is a kid with bullet holes in them. You know, because this man's waiting at a bus stop, waiting for his little daughter to get off the bus, and these pieces of crap want to leave him laying there bloody for his daughter to get off the bus and see. I mean, you know, these are the kind of scum that we're allowing and putting on the street. You know, I don't know. I'm pretty strict with my kids when it comes to things like that. They know right from wrong. And you need to make sure yours do, too, because, again, they're going to come up, the sucker punch the wrong person, and they're going to wind up 6 feet under. And then you're going to cry, oh, he was just a child. He was a child with a wild right hook, and somebody didn't teach him when and when not to use it. So, you know, blame yourself. If your kid gets killed because he's running around punching people in the face, you know, I guess it's your fault because you didn't teach him right from wrong. One more here, and then I got to get to the break. Peanut butter and jelly sandwich is racist. How many of you seen this today? This being said by a Portland school official. Now, I'm not going to get into it all. It's posted on latenightinthemidlands.com. You can check it out. It says, did you know that eating or even talking about a peanut butter and jelly sandwich could be considered racist? Apparently, it's because people in some cultures don't eat sandwich bread. Well, you know what? Good for you if you don't eat sandwich bread. So now they're going to tell the kids not to bring peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to school because it's racist. Are you kidding me? I mean, really, are you kidding me? They're trying to get me to rant tonight, aren't they? So now that you've been made aware of the evil of peanut butter and jelly, there's only one question left to answer. Is white bread more racist than whole wheat? Isn't this just ridiculous, folks? And this is kindergarten through eighth grade school in Portland. And apparently they explain why in their interview. And they're suggesting, oh, what is it here? Oh, there's a way to solve the problem. I forget. They're suggesting some kind of tortillas or something like that. You know, for the kids to bring that, not peanut butter and jelly, because, you know, some other nationality of child might be offended because you're eating peanut butter and jelly, because, you know, we've got to save the peanut butter and jelly people. We can't allow them to be eaten. It's just so wrong. You know, that's what this country's all about, saving peanut butter and jelly people. I'm Michael Vera. This is Late Night in the Midlands. We're going to have John DiNardo coming up next, so I hope you'll stay with us after that peanut butter and jelly stuff. So hang in there with us, folks. We'll be right back. I guess comets and different objects in space flinging our way, namely Comet Ison and some of these others. Now, you believe that could be the results of what?
Well, there's a large dwarf star, brown, but scientists and astronomers have determined it's probably a brown dwarf star. It was discovered by NASA scientists and astronomers, astrophysicists and astronomers some over 30 years ago, back in 1983. Even before that, NASA and other observatories in other countries knew that there was some kind of object out there, because there was some great gravitational force being exerted upon the outer planets. And this gravitational force was pulling the two of the outer planets, Neptune and Uranus, out of their orbits at one particular point in their very large orbital path. And they knew that this, what they call, what is in astronomy called a perturbation, these perturbations could only be caused by some gravitational force pulling up on these planets in their orbital travel. So that's how they knew, just by mathematical calculations of the gravitational forces, that there were some huge body out there. And this has been known, even going back to the early 1800s. So we're talking about almost 200 years this gravitational pull has been detected by astronomers.
I just want to say, so they've known about this object since the late 1800s, you said?
Yes. In fact, wow. I have in front of me a very important landmark article from the New York Times, January 30th, 1983. This is over, going on 31 years ago, and I photocopied it. So I have the exact photocopy of the article, not a transcript. I have proof that this exists. In fact, I have circulated this JPEG version of this particular New York Times article to many people on the internet, and you probably have a copy already. But this is what it says. New York Times, Sunday, January 30th, 1983. Title, Clues Get Warm in the Search for Planet X, by John Noble Wilford. Quote, something out there beyond the farthest reaches of the known solar system seems to be tugging at Uranus and Neptune. Some gravitational force keeps perturbing the two giant planets, causing irregularities in their orbits. The force suggests a presence far away and unseen, a large object that may be the long-sought Planet X. Evidence assembled in recent years has led several groups of astronomers to renew the search for the 10th planet. They are devoting more time to visual observations with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar, California. They are tracking two Pioneer spacecraft now approaching the orbit of distant Pluto to see if variations in the spacecraft's trajectories would provide clues to the source of this mysterious force. And they are hoping that a satellite-borne telescope launched last week will detect heat signatures from this planet or whatever it is out there. This is called the Infrared Astronomical Satellite, and it was boosted into a 560-mile high polar orbit Tuesday night. We're talking about 1983 now. Tuesday night from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. It represents an $80 million venture by the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands. In the next 6 or 7 months, this telescope is expected to conduct a wide-ranging survey of nearly all the sky, detecting sources not of ordinary light, but of infrared radiation, which is invisible to the human eye and largely absorbed by the atmosphere. scientists thus hope that the new telescope will chart thousands of infrared-emitting objects that have gone undetected. Stars, interstellar clouds, asteroids, and with any luck, will detect that object that pulls at Uranus and Neptune. The last time a serious search of the skies was made, it led to the discovery in 1930 of Pluto, the ninth planet. But the story begins more than a century before that, after the discovery of Uranus in 1781 by the English astronomer and musician William Herschel. Until then, the planetary system seemed to end with Saturn, as astronomers observed Uranus, noting irregularities in its orbital path. Many speculated that they were witnessing the gravitational pull of an unknown planet. So began the first planetary search based on astronomers' predictions, which ended in the 1840s with the discovery of Neptune, almost simultaneously by English, French, and German astronomers. But Neptune was not massive enough to account entirely for the orbital behavior of Uranus. Indeed, Neptune itself seemed to be affected by a still more remote planet. In the late 19th century, two American astronomers, William Pickering and Percival Lowell, predicted the size and approximate location of this trans-Neptunian body, which Lowell called Planet X. Years later, Pluto was detected by Clyde Tombaugh, working at Lowell Observatory in Arizona. And it goes on, I'll just skip a little bit here. Of course, Pluto is very small and does not have nearly enough mass to create that kind of gravitational pull on the outer planets. Anyway, recent calculations by the United States Naval Observatory have confirmed the orbital perturbation exhibited by Uranus and Neptune, which Dr. Thomas C. Van Flander, an astronomer at the observatory, says could be explained by, quote, a single undiscovered planet, unquote. He and a colleague, Dr. Robert Harrington, calculate that this 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth and have a highly elliptical orbit that takes it some 5 billion miles beyond that of Pluto, hardly next door, but still within the gravitational influence of the Sun. Just a couple of my comments here. They stated that, Dr. Harrington and Dr. Van Flander stated that this unknown object is calculated to be about 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth. Well, they were probably trying to downplay the size of this object in order to not to panic the public, because we know from what they're about to tell us a little further on in this article, they're telling us they believe it is a brown dwarf star. And the smallest brown dwarf star that would classify in that mass category within the mass of a brown dwarf star, the smallest would be about 3 times the mass of Jupiter. It would be 3 Jupiters. Now, Jupiter is known to be 318 Earth masses. That's what Jupiter is equivalent to the mass of 318 Earths combined. So, this object, if it's the smallest classified object that can be classified as a brown dwarf star, as the scientists are about to tell us in this article, well, it must be 3 times Jupiter's mass, or 3 times 318 Earths, which puts it pretty close to 1,000 Earth masses. So Dr. Harrington and Dr. Van Flander were saying it's 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth, when later on they go to tell us in an indirect way that it's actually probably at least 1,000 times more massive than Earth. And of course, we know that mass, it creates the gravitational force. The greater the mass of an object, the greater its gravitational pull. So naturally, you can understand why an object that large would be able to pull the giant gas planets, Uranus and Neptune, slightly out of their orbits at a particular point in their orbital travel. Continuing on in this article.
Okay.
According to Dr. Ray T. Reynolds of the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, other astronomers are so sure of this 10th planet, this is their quote, their words now, they are so sure that the existence of this 10th planet that they think there's nothing left but to name it, unquote. So they've done their calculations and there's no doubt that it's out there pulling on the outer planets. At a scientific meeting last summer, 10th planet partisans tended to prevail. So most of the scientists tend to agree that there was a 10th planet out there. And they were speculating on what it might be.
Right. But what I wonder now is, this thing is so huge, and I know people have explained to me that because of the positioning of where it is why we're unable to see it. But I would say there's got to be some way to see this thing.
There is. Our government, with its observatories, has definitely seen it. The problem is it's not visible to the naked, to the human eye, because it only emits infrared light. So you would need an infrared telescope to see it. And also, it's at a point. Well, that's one reason. Keep that in mind. You need infrared eyes to see it, which our government has and uses to view this object. However, there's another problem, another deterrent to viewing this object, and that is you have to be way down in the south, near the South Pole, in order to see it, and only during a couple months of the year when Earth is in this particular point in Earth's annual revolution around the sun can it be seen. So we cannot see it from the northern hemisphere, because I like to use the analogy of a big, really fat man standing upright and trying to view beneath the soles of his shoes while he's standing straight up. It's impossible because his belly is blocking his view. So he'd have to have eyes down near his feet in order to see below his feet. And that would be the South Pole. The South Pole would be analogous to the soles of his feet. The North Pole would be analogous to the top of his head. So they've had astronomers that have gone down in the southern hemisphere of the planet Earth and viewed this object at the right times. Dr. Harrington, who's mentioned in this article, is one of those scientists. He spent a good part of his career absolutely dedicated, obsessed with finding this planet X. He has written papers, and you can get some of his papers on the internet. If you type in, the search for planet X, you might be able to find it. His name is Harrington, Harrington. And in it, he calculated, he's done extensive computer calculations to determine where it was at until he got to the point where he needed to finally go down to the southern hemisphere, and specifically to the Black Birch Observatory in New Zealand with a special telescope, not a very big telescope at all, an 8-inch telescope that he had specially. The lens was specially ground for him by NASA technicians, or I'm sorry, U.S. Naval Observatory technicians, and to view this object. So if he only had an 8-inch telescope, which is rather small, that object must have been pretty big at that time in order to see it with a rather small telescope like that. And this was around, he went down to New Zealand around 1991, I believe. Somewhere around there. And came back with the plates, and he, I can give you a paraphrase what he said in his paper. He said that once those object is viewed from Black Birch Observatory, New Zealand, the photographic plates would then be delivered to the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., where they would be studied and the results would be publicized. Well, he never got to publicize those results, and those photographic plates were never seen again by anyone in public. Just like the photos, some films and photos of the Kennedy assassination were never seen again after they were confiscated. Dr. Harrington died mysteriously, and many people believe, people who studied the subject, scientists and others, believe that he was murdered. That we know, you and I know, we're aware, wise enough and learned enough to know that they have sophisticated ways of killing people.
Oh, yeah.
Cancer, for example. There are many cases where they have targeted people that they wanted out of the way with cancer. It's very fast acting.
Yeah.
It's, you know, quite easy to do. Well, anyway, without going into those grim details, that's probably what happened to Dr. Harrington, because he died of cancer within a matter of a couple of weeks. He was healthy. Everything was fine, and I believe there's all indications that he himself personally went down to New Zealand to do these astronomical observations of Planet X. And when he came, so he was robust enough to do this, and yet he came back, and in January of 1992, he died within 2 weeks of esophageal cancer. Never got a chance to publicize the findings, his photographic findings. His, what he did in his photographic travel to the South Pole, or New Zealand, close to the South Pole, what he did was take photos of Planet X. He knew precisely what small section of the sky where in which it was located, because he had done extensive calculations prior to that, so he knew just where to look for it. And he would take a photograph on one night of that particular section of the sky, and then the next night take another photograph. And Clyde Tombaugh, the man, the astronomer in 1930 who had discovered Pluto, Clyde Tombaugh had devised this method of determining, of sighting an object, a moving object, amidst millions and millions of stars, which would normally be impossible to identify amidst a field of stars. It's like looking at one grain of sand in a beach. You just can't do it. But what Clyde Tombaugh did was he would take the photograph and the next night take another photograph of that same point in the sky. And then they would alternately illuminate one slide, one of these transparent slides. They're both slides would be, one slide would be placed right on top of the other slide, superimposed exactly, so that all the stars from each, pictures of stars from each slide would line up when you saw them, one slide stacked upon the other. But they would illuminate one slide and then the other, and then illuminate the other slide and back, alternately illuminate each of the two slides at a particular speed or rate of change, such that the human eye would then be able to see any movement amongst a huge field of bright little dots on the slides. It's just an ingenious method. It's called blink comparison. And that's what the technique that Dr. Harrington used to find this object. You see, the object would have to be moving, whereas the stars are so far away. And they're not moving. They're stationary suns, actually. Each star is a sun. They're not moving at all. But this object was moving, was speculated to be moving. And that's how they were able to see it, because there was a change in just one little speck on that. Those two slides, as they were alternately blinked, were illuminated. And that's how he determined that the object was not only moving, but moving toward our solar system. and you would expect it to be moving toward our solar system because our sun is extremely massive, and our sun is like a huge fisherman reeling in a fish.
Yeah, it's incredibly large. I was looking at that about 2 nights ago, looking at some images, comparing the Earth to the sun. It's like, wow, it's like, wow, it's like a nose hair compared to the sun, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the sun is, again, we can look this up. The sun is estimated to be close to one-third of a million Earth masses. One-third of a million Earth masses. Whereas Planet X, we said before that being a dwarf, brown dwarf star, as Dr. Harrington and others believed, it's conservatively estimated to have a mass of at least 1,000 Earths. So Planet X is like 1,000 Earths, but the Sun is 300,000 Earths, close to a third of a million Earth masses. So that Sun is not going to move when it feels a gravitational attraction to Planet X. But it would be just the opposite, that Planet X is the object that would move in response to larger sun.
The sun definitely wears the pants in that relationship.
Right. So, it's true. And, that's why we would expect this object to be moving in, as Dr. Harrington's photographs probably showed. Well, when someone is murdered, someone dies suspiciously, there's more evidence right there that what they were out to discover was something that, that we all suspect is true, that this object was, at that point, identified to be moving toward our solar system. Naturally, the people who control everything, and we're so tired of hearing about, we know it with, so it's such a known fact in our lives, and even in the lives of other people who are generally ignorant of what goes on in government, who rules this world, even those people are beginning to realize that there is an elite group that does what it wants in secrecy.
Absolutely. And let me ask you this quick, John. Now, out of these scientists who have mysteriously vanished, did they ever let on to exactly, like a lot of them will say, well, they're working on something big, they're about to come out with it, and then they wind up dead. Did they ever, any of that ever get leaked to a point where we could prove what they were about to release?
No, not that I know of. I have to think about what some others now. Dr. Thomas Van Flandern, which I just mentioned in this New York Times article, was a colleague of Dr. Harrington's. And Dr. Van Flandern, I have to go back and find his quotes, but early, way back after Dr. Harrington had, in the early 90s, had went on to the Southern Hemisphere to observe Planet X, Dr. Van Flandern had made comments that he believed that this indeed was true and that they were going to discover it. But then he backed off, and it's quite clear that he was threatened. After that point, later he refused to talk, to make any statements whatsoever about it. And there's more evidence there. When a man makes statements and then he changes abruptly, decides to remain silent, then something's gone wrong. There's some kind of fear factor involved there.
Sure.
So another piece of evidence is that Dr. Van Flandern, let's suppose that he just died of cancer and it was no foul play involved. Why were not the results of the photographic observations made public? They were never made public. Everything, there was no word ever mentioned about that. So there you go. There's another smoking gun.
That's true. And didn't he find out, I guess when he found out he had cancer, wasn't it just weeks before it killed him? Isn't that a little unusual?
I mean, I don't know. You mean, did he find out about it weeks before?
Well, yeah. Somebody had told me that, you know, once he found out he had it, you know, it's like it just, it killed him in weeks. It's like he didn't get the usual 6 months to a year.
Yeah, right. That's what I had read, that he died within a couple of weeks, a very short period. From the time that he found out that he had the cancer, it was only a matter of 2 or 3 weeks, which is extremely unusual. So, you know, that's how they do it. They use radioactive materials to contaminate his body. That can happen very, you know, leukemia or some kind of cancer can happen very rapidly. Well, it's they got power elite did not want to panic the world, obviously, for money. You know, they'll do anything to maintain their power, their financial grip, and their control over the masses. So people, they understood that if the people were told that Earth was about to face some great calamity, people would no longer be fearful of the government's threats, but they would begin to prepare themselves and act independently because of the greater fear of this object causing Earth catastrophes on Earth.
And I'll tell you, you know, what makes it really hard to argue about this is because, you know, anybody with at least one eye working correctly can see that the government, and not just ours, but all of them, have been preparing for something. And the changes that this planet is going through drastically, if I may add. I mean, we're breaking records with weather and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, so when I see that stuff, I mean, some say, no, it's because they're going to bring down the New World Order on us. And then there's others who say, no, it's because they know what's coming. And I think it could be either one of those or even both.
The weather, you're right. I mean, the evidence, there are thousands and thousands. I have videotaped so many weather extremes on the Weather Channel ever since 2004.
You see the new island that formed near Japan now?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. I haven't looked into it very deeply, but yeah, you're right. And the island is rising up. I remember reading the headline about that. And in other places, too.
Yeah.
Off the coast of the Canary Islands, there's a volcano eruption coming that seems to be pushing up toward the surface of the ocean. And this is what's predicted to happen. This is what, and also in ancient historical records, they have reported that that land masses would rise out of the ocean. The great psychic, Edgar Cayce, had stated that he believes in a trance, in a hypnotic trance. He never, but you know, as a true psychic, he never consciously made any predictions, but only when he went into a trance would he be able to make these predictions in a supernatural way, that land masses would rise in the Atlantic Ocean. And I think he was referring to some point off the coast of New Jersey. But he made other predictions too. But you know, before, you know, people are uneducated people are likely to say, well, who believes these guys that call themselves psychics? They can say anything. Why should I believe them? Where's the credibility in their prophecy? Well, if you look at the history of Edgar Cayce, it's just amazing. I mean, I have a video done by ABC. They did a wonderful dramatization of the life of Edgar Cayce, and the Science Channel and the History Channel, they've all done the same thing with dramatizing Cayce's life. He started out getting into hypnosis to be cured his wife of an illness, and then other people started learning of his powers, and before long many people who were given up for death by doctors, people who had diseases and ailments that could not be cured, were knocking on Cayce's door, and he would do the best he could to try to prophesy their cause of their illnesses. one case, for example, the dramatization that I'm referring to by ABC TV, that the patient would lie down and they would, his wife and his secretary would read to him. The secretary would do the recording of his words, and his wife would read to him about a woman called Laura who had a sore on her leg and was festering, and they were contemplating amputating her leg. But he had never met this woman. She lived hundreds of miles away. But yet he'd go into a trance, and he would then say, "We are approaching the street where she lives, at State Street," and he would mention the streets. And then he would say, "It's a greenhouse. We're going into this greenhouse, going up the stairs. In the kitchen, there's something on the stove. And we're going up to the bedroom, and she's lying on the bed, and now we have the body." And then he would go into the body, I mean, in his mind, even though she was hundreds of miles away. And he would say, we're going through the heart, through the arteries, through the nervous system. And he says, "Oh, now we see the sore, the infection in her leg. It was caused by the bite of a tiny brown spider while sleeping." And then his wife would ask him, "What is the remedy, the cure for this infection?" And he said, "Oil of smoke, apply oil of smoke, will save her leg. Bancroft Pharmacy, Chicago, top shelf." So they called the Bancroft Pharmacy in Chicago, and the pharmacist said, "No, there's no oil of smoke here. It's an old company that went bankrupt several years ago." And then they came back to KC, and he went to another reading, another trance, and said, "Yes, it is. The oil of smoke is behind the blue bottle on the shelf." And they called back the pharmacy, and the pharmacist looked behind the blue bottle and said, "Oh, yeah, there it is. And we're sending it right to you immediately." Well, this was just incredible. This phenomenon that his ability to see things far away and understand things, almost like getting messages from God. And this is a phenomenon, we should say a gift, given to many people who had the ability to prophesy the future. Nostradamus, for example, was a great healer. He had this power also. I'm not saying these people were Christians or children of God, but God seems to choose whomever he pleases to people who are to do his work, to carry out his messages, deliver his messages to the world. Nostradamus, again, just like Edgar Casey, was a great healer, and was given visions of the earth going into a cataclysmic tumble, a sudden jolt, where Earth would rotate vertically, sort of toppling, or a slow roll over a period of several months. Now, Nostradamus lived in the early 1500s, and so he made Earth changes prophecies to, just like other prophets have done, prophesying great catastrophes. Well, Edgar Casey, in addition to many healing visions that he got, and he had done thousands of these healings, incidentally. I mean, they're all recorded. It's not hearsay, but all of his detailed readings in a trance where he would heal people whom he had never met, but who wrote letters to him pleading for help. They're all recorded in great detail and stored at a huge library in Virginia Beach, Virginia. It's called the Association for Research and Enlightenment. So all the documents can be seen there. He also predicted the Wall Street crash of 1929. Edgar Casey, incidentally, during the first half of the 20th century, and died around 1941, I believe, somewhere around there. during his time, he predicted a Wall Street crash months before it happened. He also predicted the invention of laser light and the communism and other great global events.
Yeah, he was incredible. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, he was incredible. And, you know, I know there's a lot of phony psychics out there, but there are some real ones, and I've come across a couple of them myself. But Edgar Cayce, I think he takes the cake.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I agree. Others have made predictions and prophecies very much like Cayce, as you say, but he has done more in that realm than anyone that I can think of. In his readings, he would come out with these grim and horrifying predictions, and I can paraphrase some of them. Okay. And this is around in the 1930s, I believe, many of these earth changes predictions were made when he was in a hypnotic trance. And one of the things he said was, the earth the greater portion of Japan must go into the sea. And that was made, again, somewhere in the 1930s. Now we see the beginnings of that horrible transformation, the destruction of Japan, sinking into the sea. We saw a massive earthquake in March of 2011. And now the nuclear disaster, but of course we would not attribute the nuclear disaster to the sinking of the landmass of Japan. However, if any more earthquakes occur, incidentally, I just heard a report this morning. It was from some scientists. So they put it on YouTube. And they're sort of speculating that there may be another earthquake. If that's the case, if there's another huge earthquake in Japan, the whole west coast of the United States would have to be evacuated.
Yeah.
Because the Fukushima would so contaminate the Pacific Ocean with radioactivity that it would reach the shores of the west coast of the U.S. and Canada.
I think it already is reaching maybe on a small level right now. I know they've detected levels of radiation above normal in milk and things like that, different produce. And then there's this big pile of junk that's washing up, going to be washing up, I guess, ashore. So, you know, and it's pouring, what, over 1,000 tons of nuclear waste into the ocean every day? I mean, you know, it's
just, yeah. It's so horrifying that we just want to cry, actually, to think of what's about to happen to this earth. And we're getting off the subject a little bit with this nuclear threat, but it's certainly worth mentioning.
It is.
That this is just one nuclear power plant. How many are there in the United States? How many nuclear power plants do we have? Hundreds of them. And when these earthquakes start going off, and this is what's frustrating to me, Michael, is that very few people know that the earthquakes are going to get worse. I know this, but nobody would listen to me when I tell them that this Fukushima, as horrific as it is, and poisonous it is to all of humankind, is just one of hundreds of radioactive time bombs that's about to go off.
You're right. You know,
if earthquakes were going to, it's going to happen with the earthquakes.
Yeah, and if the power should go out, say an EMP of some sort, you know, think about it. All these things, I mean, they're only going to be able to power them for so long. And it's going to be just like Fukushima, only on a worldwide level, where, you know, people aren't going to stay there toying with it. They're going to see all hell breaking loose everywhere, and they're going to take off and leave it.
That's right, because as you say, when power goes out, we have a long-term power outage due to the real and anticipated solar blasts that are beginning to occur now, which would take down the power grid. That power grid is coming down permanently and or indefinitely. Now, as you and I know, what you're referring to is the fact that it takes many months, I don't know how many months, to gracefully shut down, cool down a nuclear reactor, so that it doesn't go into meltdown. And they don't have enough, that means you have to power that nuclear reactor to gracefully shut it down, cool it down. But there's not enough electrical power, as you stated, because you need lots of fuel stored up to continue with the powering the backup generators for that nuclear power plant.
And let's face it, a lot of these things are built right near the water. So if it's caused by, if they go out because of earthquakes, well, here comes tsunamis again.
Right. So, I mean, with the case, in the case of Fukushima, they were not even able to turn on the backup power because the generators got flooded by the tsunami.
Yeah.
And even let's take a look at the other nuclear power plants that may not be threatened by flooding. They're not going to have enough fuel to continue. Well, hopefully they'll be able to deliver more fuel, enough fuel to keep these nuclear power plants running so that they can shut them down over that, cool them down over that long period of months, I guess it is. Hopefully they can supply enough fuel, but it's likely that they will not be able to continue to power their generators due to natural disasters, due to flooding or whatever. So we're going to have many, many Fukushimas in the United States. That means goodbye mankind.
Exactly. I mean, you look at Fukushima right now and the way they're handling that. Imagine on a worldwide scale. And then, you know, we've got several in this country alone that are designed exactly like Fukushima's. And we've got some now that are having problems. I know there's one in South Carolina that's got a leak, but they say, oh, don't worry about it. There's one in Alabama that I know has a leak as well. And I got information, how true it is. I think it's pretty accurate, but I can't back it up 100%, but that they actually tried to drop a couple nukes on South Carolina, and it was faded off, and it was 600 miles off the coast. They detonated these things, and there's some high military personnel who's been fired over it for stopping it. I don't know if you've heard anything about that. So it just shows how sick they are.
I mean, why would they detonate these nukes off the coast of South Carolina? What was their purpose?
I think they wanted to drop them on South Carolina and then, of course, blame some other country for it.
But, for a false flag.
Yeah,
but a false flag attack so that they could have a war.
Yeah, and then you think about all the... I think South Carolina has the most in this state than any other state of nuclear power plants. So you drop a nuke here, and it's not just that nuclear bomb you've got to worry about. How about all those power plants that are going to go meltdown? So, you know, that was a pretty sick attempt, if I may say so, from whoever was trying to do that.
Oh, yeah, these people are evil. I mean, they're like the devil. Anyone, and again, Dick Cheney, our former vice president.
Yeah.
He's one of the guys who tried to deliver a nuke and get it from the Minot Air Force Base, as we all know, several years ago. And they refused to give it up. And several of those valiant Air Force men were killed, murdered, because they refused to violate their oath and their orders not to release anything like, you know, a nuclear weapon, except under certain restricted circumstances. And Cheney tried to do it, get them to release the weapon so that it could be used against Iran or some other Middle Eastern country and start a war. I mean, the man is a devil. And these men died just to protect the people of this country, protect the people of the world. I mean, we could have had a nuclear war because of this maniac, evil man.
And if it does happen, you know, half of the sheeple in this country will believe the official story, whatever they're told. And that's why we never get nowhere, because people always fall for the propaganda and the lies. And, you know, if they're trying to nuke their own country like that, I mean, my God, if they'll kill an American president, could be killed and they get away with that. 9/11 and God knows how many other things. I mean, I could be here all night naming stuff off. I mean, that just shows how sick these people are and that they'll go to any extent. Now, I'm wondering if they are aware that, you know, we've got some destruction coming from above. Why are they doing all this? Is there a method to their madness?
Well, being as someone who has studied the Bible and prayed and seen the real tangible results of the Bible, what God's word, I can tell you that what is throughout the Bible, there is a thread of testimony stating that there are spiritual beings, fallen angels, that are thoroughly evil, that are indwell men. And as far as we're getting into something spiritual now, that people, because people cannot see it, it's hard for them to believe. And again, I come from I'm a former high school physics teacher, and I spent most of my career in electronics. So I come from a scientific mindset, and where I never believed, for many years, I never believed in anything spiritual or metaphysical I could not see, or that cannot be, could not be scientifically proven. But I've learned since then that our science is primitive in its development, and there are many realities of spirituality that can be explained in terms of physics, in terms of scientific proof, research, that we, our science, field of science, has not yet developed to understand. And some of these things are psychic. We just talked about Edgar Cayce. There's evidence right there that there's proof that supernatural events do occur. Predicting the future. How could anyone predict the future? I used to think it's impossible. Anyone who says they can predict the future is crazy, because the future is unpredictable. The events are random, but now I understand that God has control over every event that occurs from the beginning of time until the end of time. Otherwise, Edgar Cayce would never be able to predict these things, because it comes from God. Nostradamus, Edgar Cayce would never be able to predict these earth changes, or to be able to heal people, to go hundreds of miles away in their minds, in through a body of an ailing person, and see the environment in which that person lives, and see the body, the insides of the internal structure, and find the cause of their ailment. That is just so amazing that we have to accept it because of the truthfulness of their, the accuracy of their, the results that they've gotten. So getting back to the reason, you say, why would these men do such evil things, their leaders? Because there are spiritual beings that are in rebellion against God. And these are, one in particular is the leader of these spiritual beings, fallen angels. His name, we all have heard, is Satan, or the devil. And there are, again, billions. I speculate that there are billions of angels that exist in another dimension, that they can see us, but we cannot see them. They can indwell a person without that person even knowing it. And I can see it in my own life, that some of the things I've done, some of the bad things I've done in my life, nothing unlawful, but just humanly bad. And I look back on now, because I'm closer to God, I'm bringing my spirit of God closer to my mind and my heart. Now I can see the things that I did bad that I never recognized before. So these demons, these fallen angels, actually indwell people. And that's what the Lord Jesus Christ had told us a number of times in the Bible, in the four Gospels. He states that if you're not with me, you're against me. And that's a hard statement to understand. But what he means is everyone is indwelled by a spirit, either by an evil spirit or by the Spirit of God. And if we are left to our own without envisioning God in our minds, basically it's silent prayer. It's consciously feeling the presence of God. If we are left to our own devices and do not do that, just go off and try to live a good life and make things, well, automatically we are indwelled by demonic spirits. And of course, they do not turn us into raving evil fiends, but they cause us to be unaware of the presence of God and to do things which are, every one of us has done things that are unethical or hurtful to others. And I know I've done that many times without even thinking that it was bad, hurting other people's feelings. And now that I look back, because the Spirit of God is now, I have cultivated it with knowledge and the awareness of the Spirit of God, and I realize what I've done. These men are totally indwelled by Satan. Now, people might say, well, you're looking at it in a subjective way. This may not be true. There may not be demons, demonic spirits that indwell men. I can tell you, we all know that these men believe it. They worship Satan.
They sure do. They sure do.
The Bush family.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Skull and Bones Secret Society is a society that worships Satan. They call him Lucifer. They wouldn't even call him Satan, because Satan in Hebrew means the adversary of God. They prefer to call him, this demon spirit, Lucifer, which means the light bearer. So they believe that the devil, Satan, Lucifer, is the light, the light of truth. Of course, they're demented because they've been influenced by these demonic spirits. They've been totally turned over to him. And you probably have seen many movies. One of them is called, titled The Devil's Advocate, which shows that a man can have great success if he sells his soul to the devil. And I used to think, well, that's a fanciful concept, because I saw many TV shows and movies about, well, several movies about that concept. In fact, it was, wasn't that a great classic? Was it a musical or, yeah, a musical called Faust, where a man sells his soul to the devil. And that goes back 100 years ago.
All right. Hang on for a moment, John. We've got to take a break here. And then when we come back, I'll let you pick right up where you left off. And we'll take some questions from the audience as well. 803-317-2264. Or you can private message me any questions you might have in the late night in the Midlands chat room. So with that, folks, hang on with us for just a moment. We're going to take a break. This is Late Night in the Midlands on the LNM Radio Network. We'll be right back. Folks, we're straightforward here. We give it to you raw. We don't sugarcoat it. There's no control here. We cover everything, whether it can be proven, and sometimes it cannot. And it depends, I guess. You know, something like this, Planet X, like I say, there's great arguments for it, great arguments against it. I will not dismiss it until I could prove without a reasonable doubt that it don't exist. Because, you know, something is happening. And, you know, I know some people, they get so offensive when you talk about things like this. And then there's others who get so offensive if you say you don't believe in something like this. I say, here's a trail for you to follow, and now look into it. But I assure you, it comes to Planet X, the rabbit hole is so damn deep, just like so many other things. You know, it's really, you got to weed through a lot of the garbage to get to the good stuff. The fact is, our government has been looking for this object for a long time. They found it, apparently. I remember reading the articles. So, you know, I know some people say that it was put out there as a psyop, John, and others say no. Either way, I'm not definitely not going to argue that. I think there is something to it. I really do. So I want you to pick back up where you left off. But first we got a question from the chat. And what they want to know, and maybe you'll want to get to this after you finish, but they want to know if Comet Ison is a direct relation to Planet X, if it's being pushed out by it or if it's part of it or anything like that.
Yeah, it probably is. You know, if you go back to the late 20th century, the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, we never had comets coming in close to the sun. I recall, I mean, I've never read anything in the news about it, and I've never seen any horrific weather like we've been getting now. Now, however, we've been getting these comets coming in quite frequently. Comet Ison, Comet Elenin, Comet Neat. Over the last decade, there have been many big comets that have come close to the sun. This is extremely unusual. This indicates that there is now a flurry of comets coming in, being drawn in gravitationally by our sun. And what would accompany a mass of comets? What would be causing this flurry of comets to be coming in? It would be a large object. Most logically, it would be a very large object that holds these comets in its gravitational force field, captured. It's like a beehive with bees swarming all around it.
Yeah, if it was one, I would say, oh, well, you know, it's another comet. But we're talking about, you know, first it's one, then it's two, three, four of them coming. And I guess Ison has broke off with two tails now. And apparently it had a pretty good electrical charge with Mars when it passed by. And I know that if it survives its trip around the sun, it's going to come pretty close to us, too.
Right. So, you know, these devastating, menacing comets are probably very likely part of the entourage, the gang of comets that are gravitationally captured by this huge dwarf star, which NASA has identified as Planet X. We're going to be seeing more of them. We're going to be seeing more Earth disasters. I'm concerned that this Comet Ison has yet may soon cause even more disasters on Earth. The weather we've been seeing is probably caused by this Comet Ison. These horrible tornadoes that hit the Midwest just a few days ago.
Look at the Philippines.
And the Philippines, Typhoon Haiyan, they stated that this was the worst typhoon hurricane in recorded history anywhere in the world ever that they have known about. So there you go. I mean, we know everyone has to believe it. Every logical person, thinking person, has to realize that we're in great danger. Earth is undergoing horrible changes. It's catastrophic weather events, catastrophic earthquake periods, intervals of very numerous and very intense earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, and they will get worse. People are, you know, of course everyone wants to hide from the truth, but it's better that we face the truth and prepare for it now. And later on we should talk about preparations. There are physical preparations.
Absolutely.
Emergency electrical power, how to get your own food and survive, and how to get your own water. There are many ways we can do this. We'll talk about that later, but let's face the reality now that Earth is in great danger, and those who do not know about Planet X are the ones who are going to suffer. I just wish that I could get on television. I mean, I'm basically a shy person. I don't like to speak to large crowds, but I know that this is something that the humankind is in danger. It needs to be alerted to this danger. And I wish I could speak to the world as to what's happening, that, and tell them the bad news, that things will not get better. The earthquakes will not decrease in frequency and intensity. intensity, they will increase. The weather events will get worse. I was watching those people in Washington, Illinois, whose homes had been turned into piles of debris. And in an instant, I was thinking, if the world only knew that they think that these people are just a very small, unfortunate minority, if they only knew that their homes are going to be destroyed too, very soon. Well, I don't know when. I never put time stamps on anything, but when these events ramp up as they are, the earth will get to such a point where everybody's home will be blown down. I know it's horrible to contemplate something like that, but we have to get dome structures. The dome can be very small. We don't have the resources to build a huge home that's shaped like a dome, but we can get a small dome that could be maybe 15 feet in diameter, in which a family could go into. The dome could be partially submerged underground, so that when the wind hits it because of its shape, it can withstand 300 mile an hour winds. That's what we have to start planning for. And I have not even done that myself, but I know that there are companies now that are making domes. And that's what we have, some of the things we have to do to save lives.
Yeah, I have a company that we've got their banner on the website right now. They're called Hardened Structures, and they do that kind of thing. They build above-ground shelters to withstand up to 200 to 250 mile-an-hour winds, and they have them, like what you just mentioned, partially in the ground, partially... I mean, they even do covert structures for government, which, of course, I had the guy on. He couldn't talk too much about it, but... So yeah, you know, that's something that if somebody can afford it, it's not a bad thing to have. I mean, you know, you never know. I can't afford that, so I'm going to have to get out my hand gliders and hope for the best.
Yeah. Well, keep on advertising that, because people need to know these things. If we can convince people that they've got to start putting energy and money into preparations to protect themselves and to have food, survive, and all that.
And while the money...
Many lives.
Yeah, I was going to say, and while the money is still worth anything.
That's right. I mean, spend it on something that's going to be useful. Food, even, you know, even gold and silver will be worth nothing, as the Bible tells us, in comparison to the necessities, water. And, well, we know this is true, so we don't have to... I don't have to emphasize that point, that we have to store water. And that's one of the things that I do. I have so many empty plastic bottles and filled with water and stacked up in my basement. And when, you know, it takes a lot of water just to support one person.
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, John, you, myself, and others have been telling people for quite a while now that, you know, I don't know, like the last storm, we'd say, like even with Sandy and Katrina, oh, well, that's nothing. It's going to get worse. And it has. Each time, they keep getting bigger and stronger. And, you know, people keep denying, saying, oh, well, it's a fluke, or it's global warming. No, folks, it's not.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot bigger than that.
That wishful thinking is what the government is trying to put into people's heads. And make us believe that's global warming and that man can reverse it. Well, they're doing that because they don't care about the public. They want their economy to survive, and they want their greed. They want to get the full, reap the full essence of all that they've been stealing from the people. And then go into their underground shelters and leave everybody to fend for themselves. That's what they're planning to do. So they don't care. They're hoping that they can eliminate much of the population, because that's their goal anyway. These men are evil. Again,
yeah.
We get back to the spiritual beings of Satan that indwell these men, cause them to be so evil. So please, people who listen to your show know this is true. We just have to get the truth to others. And they're beginning to see that the men who rule us are indeed evil. And in order for us to survive, we've got to start preparing right now. Yes, Comet Ison is most likely associated with Planet X, part of the one of those many bees that are a surrounding that huge beehive, Planet X. We're not getting into all the scientific evidence. We see the evidence going back before these men were murdered, before these scientists like Dr. Harrington were murdered, that they did reveal to the public that there is an object out there. And Dr. Harrington, I'm reading for the New York Times again, January 1983, quote, more credence was given to the hypothesis that a brown dwarf star accounts for this mysterious gravitational force, referring to the force that pulls on the outer planets and causes perturbations in their orbits. Continuing on, this is the informal name. Brown dwarf star is the informal name that astronomers give to celestial bodies that were not massive enough for their thermonuclear furnaces to ignite. Sort of like a baby sun that never got to be large enough. Perhaps like the huge planet Jupiter, that's an example, which just missed being a self-illuminating star. Anyway, so that's the essence of that New York Times article, January 1930th. And what they were doing, that article was issued in January 1983 in order to herald the launch of the infrared astronomical satellite, something that NASA was proud of at that time, before they were muzzled by the evil, secretive National Security Agency, which rules all of the government agencies, the NSA, spying on everyone, keeping the truth from us, and ruining our lives.
Yeah.
That was the agency that later came in and prevented NASA from putting out any further information about the discovery of Planet X. That's why you heard nothing more, or virtually nothing more about it since then. But we're still in 1983 now, before NASA came out and muzzled, before the NSA, National Security Agency, came out and muzzled NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Okay, so they were launching the infrared astronomical satellite in January. It was heralded by the New York Times article that I just read to you. Now, that same year, not January, but December, the last month of the year, nearly the last day of the year, December 30th, 1983, front page Washington Post. Two of the largest papers, January, New York Times, December, 83, Washington Post. I read this article. Again, I photocopied it. This is not a transcript. It's the actual article. I put that out on the internet, too, so people could see the real evidence. December 30th, 1983, Washington Post front page, quote, possibly as large as Jupiter, a mystery heavenly body discovered, possibly as large as Jupiter, by Thomas O'Toole, Washington Post staff writer, quote, a heavenly body possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of this solar system has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. infrared astronomical satellite. So they found what they were looking for. 11 months later. So mysterious is this object that astronomers do not know if it is a planet, a giant comet, a nearby protostar that never got hot enough to become a star. But we know that's what they speculated that it was. That's the brown dwarf star that we were referring to. Here they call it nearby protostar that never got hot enough to become a star. Protostar means something in its initial development, etc. Or we don't know if it's a distant galaxy so young that it's still in the process of forming its first stars, or if it's a galaxy so shrouded in dust that none of the light cast by its stars ever gets through. I'm going to interrupt your reading of this article here to point out that they're injecting disinformation. You can see it. They knew what they were looking for. They knew they were looking for a protostar, a brown dwarf star. In January 1983 New York Times article. Now, when they discovered it in December, Washington Post are pretending that, well, it could be a brown dwarf star. They don't even call it a brown dwarf, they call it a polar star. Or it could be another galaxy, or it could be a, something else. So they're throwing disinfo in there to make it seem quite nebulous, and not be specific, to avoid, or avoid the actual, you know, their statements earlier in the year about the actuality of this object. Because, again, they're probably the people in charge, people overseeing it, were telling them to make it appear nebulous so that they would not panic the public with the reality that it's a brown dwarf star. Anyway, continuing to read, quote, "All I can tell you is that we don't know what it is," Dr. Jerry Neugebauer, infrared astronomical satellite chief scientist. Let me say that again. Quote, "All I can tell you is that we don't know what it is," said Dr. Jerry Neugebauer, infrared astronomical satellite chief scientist for California's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and director of the Palomar Observatory for the California Institute of Technology, said in an interview. Well, he's lying, Jerry Neugebauer. He says, "Oh, we don't know what it is." They just stated that they knew what it was 11 months earlier in the New York Times. So, see, now we're catching them in the lie. And we're proving by their lies that this object was indeed found. See, President Nixon, who was the victim of the Watergate scandal and ousted from office based upon that, he said, has once stated, that it's not the crime that we can see that really exposes the criminal. It's the cover-up that really exposes him. And if you look at the Kennedy assassination and so many other evil acts by the men in power, it's their cover-ups that expose their evil and prove that they had committed the crime. It's exactly what's happening here. 11 months later, they're lying and twisting their original statements, such that they're claiming they don't know what it is. And another thing, right in the article, we're reading on without going into all the details, Jerry Neugebauer says, "All I can tell you," quoting, "all I can tell you is it's not incoming mail. I want to douse that idea with as much cold water as possible." Well, wait a minute. He doesn't know that it's not incoming. There's absolutely no proof. He's stating that because he's making a propaganda statement trying to pacify the public. So that, because at that time there was stated in this Washington Post article that scientists, astronomers, astrophysicists believed that this object was indeed incoming, being gravitationally pulled in by the sun. So he wanted to douse that idea with as much cold water as possible. Again, the cover-up proves the criminal crime. The cover-up highlights the crime. So we know that this object is coming in, and then nothing was said about it. Well, something leaked out in 1984, the very next year, and that was about the last leak you ever got about Planet X. It leaked out into the third largest news magazine in the United States, U.S. News and World Report. And I've got the article again. I photocopied that from my library, too, and I put that on the internet, so it's the actual article proving that this was actually revealed. And I'm reading from the actual article.
Okay.
U.S. News and World Report, September 10, 1984, titled, "Planet X, Is It Really Out There?" Quote, "Shrouded from the sun's light, mysteriously tugging at the orbits of Uranus and Neptune, is an unseen force that astronomers suspect may be Planet X, a tenth resident of the Earth's celestial neighborhood. Last year, the infrared astronomical satellite, IRAS, circling in a polar orbit 560 miles from the Earth, detected heat from an object about 50 billion miles away that is now the subject of intense speculation." Quote, "All I can say is we don't know what it is yet," says Jerry Neugebauer, director of the Palomar Observatory for the California Institute of Technology. "Scientists are hopeful that the one-way journeys of the Pioneer 10 and 11 space probes may help to locate this nameless body. Incidentally, they're referring to the Pioneer 10, 11. Pioneer 10 was sent out there in the direction where their calculations told them that planet X was existed as due to the perturbations, the particular pull and direction of the perturbations, gravitational effects on the outer planets. So they sent Pioneer 10 out there, close to that calculated region where they suspected that this object was located. And they correctly assumed that it would exert a gravitational pull on the actual space probe, Pioneer 10 space probe, which it did. And it was never revealed, but the mission was successful. They don't tell you the results of these missions that we're paying for. They never tell you. But they proved from that, because evidently we can infer that they did, that there was a gravitational pull on the Pioneer 10 space probe, because they went on to build this huge infrared, along with this expensive project, the infrared astronomical satellite, to verify even more, with even more certainty, which I just read to you, the launching of the infrared astronomical satellite. That proves that the Pioneer 10 space probe achieved its mission, and indeed was gravitationally pulled off of its trajectory at that particular point where they expected. So they said, yeah, this object is definitely there. Let's send up the infrared astronomical satellite and have it sight in on this infrared emitting object so we can further ascertain its location.
I wish I had a bunch of rich nerds for friends. I really do. I would love to have them build something, something simple, infrared, and just send it up and see what the heck we see. Boy, that'd be nice.
Well, we got a lot of amateur astronomers that have infrared telescopes, and those are the guys who are going to be seeing it now. I'm surprised that, I guess they haven't sighted it yet. My estimation is that it's somewhere between, it is now located somewhere between Jupiter and Saturn. It's coming up, as Dr. Harris stated, coming up from below the ecliptic plane. And without going into a lot of detail, the ecliptic plane is that invisible disk in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun. And Dr. Harrington said that it was coming up before he was murdered back in January of 1992. He stated that it was coming up from below the ecliptic in his paper titled The Search for Planet X, from below the ecliptic at an angle of about 40 degrees with respect to the ecliptic. And to give you a visual image of what he's talking about, if you were had a visualized in a restaurant a large circular table, and someone is on the floor, lying on the floor off to the side of the table, and they were to fire a ball bearing up from the floor off to the side toward the underside of that circular table. That circular table would be analogous to our ecliptic, which is the visible plane in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun. And that object, that ball bearing, would then come from the underside, up through the underside of the table, at an angle with respect to the underside of the table. And then it would penetrate the table. It would not penetrate the table at the center, but off to the side, around sort of the outer portion of the table. That's where Jupiter and Saturn would be rotating or revolving around on top of that table. And now you can visualize what we're talking about. That ball bearing is coming up now, and it's now beginning to penetrate the underside of the table. And now we see storms over the last few years, storms on Jupiter, which are incredible. Storms on Saturn. We've seen comets crashing into the southern hemisphere of Jupiter over the last few years. All of these are indirect indications that this huge body and its entourage of surrounding comets is passing by, causing storms on Saturn. Some of its outline, its objects captured, some of Planet X's captured comets are now crashing into the southern hemisphere of Jupiter. The evidence is there. It's been photographed. And why is it that we have to have amateur astronomers sighting these comet crashes into Jupiter when NASA itself is capable of seeing them all, and yet NASA is not reporting them, but the amateur astronomers are reporting them? Because again, the big cover-up is in effect. The government doesn't want us to know about it, but the amateur astronomers are beginning to tell the truth. That's why we suspect that Planet X is now out there, somewhere between Jupiter and Saturn, getting closer into the ecliptic, coming up into that disk, that invisible disk, shoulder to shoulder with Saturn and Jupiter. Saturn on the one side and Jupiter on the other side. And it's going to continue to come up, not only shoulder to shoulder with those planets, but above, looping up. Now, why would it come up and loop up and then come inward over the top of the ecliptic plane, soaring over the top of the sun? Because it's coming in like, it's going to go like a boomerang. It's going, the sun is pulling it, and it will not crash directly into the sun, but it makes a curved U-turn around the sun, coming up from below and then up over the top of the sun. That's the way, in basic physics, you can expect an object to travel, which is an object which is gravitationally pulled in by the sun. It's sort of like, you can imagine a man, which would be analogous to the sun, who is holding a large rope or string, and at the end of that string is a heavy metal ball. He's wielding that thing and swinging it. He's going to swing it up from below over his head, and because of the force that he's exerting, the inward force, the centripetal force that he's exerting on an object, that object will make a curved trajectory over and around his head. And that's exactly what this object is going to do. That's why it's coming up in a curved U-turn through the ecliptic and then over and above. But as it, in its travel, its destination toward above the sun, it has to pass over the orbital paths of all the planets inward from Jupiter. That means it has to pass over the orbital path of Jupiter, then next over the orbital path of Mars, then next over the orbital path of Earth, and so on, until it passes over the top of the Sun, and then comes back down again, passing over the orbital paths of the inner planets once again, so we get a double whammy. It's going to pass over Earth on its inbound approach above the Sun, over the Sun.
Now, let me ask you this.
Over the Earth again on its outbound approach after it passes over the Sun.
Let me ask you this, John. Now, if it's going to come around and it's going to actually be that close to the Sun, how does it not get pulled into the Sun? Because that Sun is huge. And you think
right.
that the gravity...
It's centrifugal force. Centrifugal force. The word fugal being related to, derived from the word fugitive. Fleeing. Center fleeing force. When you drive your car around a sharp corner, around a corner, and when you're going too fast, what happens? You and all the passengers are pulled outward, away from the corner. Right? The center fleeing force. And if you go drive fast enough, you can actually cause that car to fly outward and lose its grip on the road and tumble over due to the tremendous centrifugal force acting on it. And that's the only reason, it's the only thing that keeps this object from crashing into the sun. The sun is pulling it toward it, yes, but the centrifugal or centrifugal force pulling it, causing it to flee away from the sun, is counterbalancing it. And those two forces, the inward centripetal force and the outward centrifugal force, counterbalance one another until they both reach a state of equilibrium. They cancel one another out, and the net effect is that this planet X makes a big U-turn around the sun at a particular radial distance from the sun. The That's exactly what's going to happen based upon. This is not speculation. This is absolutely predictable physics.
Okay.
And what it does, we get a double whammy, as I said before, because at first it has to travel over the orbital paths, the orbital rings of all the inner planets, including Earth, and it goes over the top of the Sun, where when it gets close to the Sun, it's going to cause horrendous spiking electrical discharges to the Sun, which are going to create such electrical excitations that we'll have X-rays, we'll have gamma rays, we'll have particle beams, winds, solar winds that are blown out toward the Earth that will be catastrophic. It has happened in the past. Again, we can take basic physics and fortify our prediction by pointing to the same occurrence in ancient history numerous times, a number of times. How can we do that? How can we go back? People don't have much of a grip on ancient history. It's very difficult to find these events, but we have. I can show you where this object is shown to be on an orbital path every 36 and a half centuries. It comes into Earth and causes great devastation. If we go back with geological records, ecological records, we see that Earth tree rings around the world. If you go to Wikipedia, you can look up the tree rings being narrowed around 36 and a half centuries ago. And they stated in this Wikipedia article that it's very, you can very accurately narrow down the time of the tree rings being narrowed to, you know, within an accuracy of plus or minus 10 or 20 years.
Now, what does that mean if they're narrowed?
It means that when the tree rings are narrowed, the trees got very little sustenance, light. They were deprived of light because the earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, are so prolific around the Earth that you have clouds of ash cast up, blocking the Sun, and the trees become withered for that period of time. The ash cloud is blocking the Sun around the globe. Now, this has happened already with Mount St. Helens in 1980, and that was just one volcanic eruption in Washington State that caused an ash cloud. That when it was global, it was dispersed globally into the upper atmosphere. Now, can you imagine 140 volcanoes all exploding at the same time?
And then throw in the nuclear power plants with that.
Yeah,
Not good.
You have like a nuclear winter, actually.
Yeah.
And all the trees become withered, all the vegetation dies. You have destruction of human and other biological life.
And I would assume that this planet would wind up looking, at least for a long time, just kind of like what Mars looks like, huh?
Yeah. Well, Mars, according to Dr. Velikovsky, a brilliant scientist, a theoretician, I guess you might call it, died in the 1950s. Dr. Velikovsky said that Mars, this planet came by, or planet Venus actually, was one of the members of the beehive of Planet X. Just imagine that, a huge comet. I mean, Venus is smaller than Earth, but still it's pretty good size for a comet. It would be considered a very large comet. And that comet was one of the many bees surrounding and gravitationally captured by this huge Planet X when Planet X came by many centuries ago.
So it's kind of like
what it did was it sucked the water off of Mars in the atmosphere. That's why Mars lost its atmosphere. But yeah, Mars is a little bit different. I think with no atmosphere, it's a whole different story. But it's catastrophic nonetheless.
Right, and I'm just wondering if maybe every time this thing comes around, maybe it drops off another planet or something, and it, you know, maybe it shifts. Maybe there was life on Mars, it wiped them out, and now there's life, you know, something like that, like trade-offs.
Yeah, I mean, that's what many scientists, from James McCanney and others, believe that there was life on Mars, and there was water on Mars, and yeah, who knows, but definitely can change by these passages, because there's a gravitational pull when these comets come by. If comet Ison, I don't know how big it is, but it could actually, if it gets close enough to Earth, and hopefully it doesn't, but it depends on where Earth happens to be in Earth's annual revolution around the Sun, what season of the year, when comet Ison happens to pass by. But if comet Ison gets close enough, it will definitely cause major earthquakes.
Well, the chart that I'm looking at, I have it up on my website, and it shows the path of comet Ison as it comes around the Sun. Should it survive that whip around the Sun, when it's coming back, going back out, Earth will actually, you know, and comet Ison will actually come very close to one another. And comet Ison looks pretty big, and you know, it's a lot of dust and stuff, but I mean, it looks pretty substantial, if what I'm looking at's accurate.
Right, I mean, because of its mass, and I don't know how big it is, but if it's big enough, the major factor is the distance from Earth. You know, that's even much more influential a factor in gravitational pull, is the distance, more so than the actual mass. The mass, of course, is very important in determining the amount of gravitational pull that it would exert on Earth. But distance is even more influential. And when that happens, it pulls on the surface of Earth, it flux the crustal surface of Earth, and causes tremendous earthquakes. This is what's happened in the past. Now, we go back 36 and a half centuries. We saw the tree rings. Scientists have proven, ecologists have proven, that the tree rings were narrow, not only in the United States and in the American continent, but also in Europe. All the trees have narrow tree rings about 36 and a half centuries ago. So there we've got a pretty good thumbtack on the timeline, the chronological timeline of this object coming in when it came in the past. If we can go back another 36 and a half centuries and find some great gravitational, some great geological disasters that occurred another 36 and a half centuries before this previous 36 and a half centuries ago, then we could pretty much nail down the index, the periodic passages of this object, the timing of it. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, what's all this about timing? I thought it was just a random entry of a large brown dwarf star. Well, here's what's happening. It's a comet. Now, if you look up the definition of a comet, comets are periodic, like a celestial pendulum. You can predict the period of the pendulum based upon its mass and its length. And gravity. Now, you can do the same thing with a celestial pendulum comet. Comets come in because of their mass and because of whatever they may be revolving around. You can expect a comet to come in like clockwork. Halley's Comet, for example, comes in, we know when it's going to come in, every 75 years, approximately.
Yeah.
And why? Why would that be? Well, it comes in on a highly elliptical orbit. That elliptical orbit is sort of like, if you can imagine, a bicycle chain, okay, a very long bicycle. The bicycle chain going around the pedal wheel sprocket, pedal sprocket wheel, and then around the rear wheel sprocket. That describes a huge elliptical path. And that's the kind of path we're talking about, but it's very stretched out. If you were to take a circle, a rubber O-ring, okay, nice circular O-ring, and put it between your two hands and pull outward on it, you would stretch that O-ring out because it deformed, just come to a shape, the shape of an ellipse. That's the kind of orbital trajectory that these comets take. And this Planet X is scientifically shown, even though we cannot see the distant sun, there is a distant dead sun that is a twin to our sun. And astrophysicists and astronomers will tell you that most solar systems that have been discovered are binary. Binary meaning two, having two suns. So our solar system is quite common.
And it has a dark sun, right? Isn't that what they call it?
Dark sun. on, and that's what this object is revolving around. It's making a huge elliptic path, just like a stretched out O-ring. First it's being pulled to one side, and then it loops around that one side. Again, it doesn't crash into that dead side, because it's on a trajectory, it's got momentum, and it begins to be whipped around. It makes a U-turn around it, because its centrifugal force counterbalances the inward pull, which is the centripetal force, and the centrifugal and centripetal forces balance one another until there's an equilibrium that results in their looping effect. So now Planet X loops around the dead sun, and it takes about, well, half of 36 and a half centuries to come back to loop around our sun. That's when it causes all the devastation. It takes a total of, to make one complete cycle from our sun all the way around to the dead sun and then back to our sun, it takes 36 and a half centuries. And we're about to prove that by showing that the tree rings were narrow 36 and a half centuries ago. Now let me show, take you back to another event prior to that 36 and a half centuries ago, which would have been what? Would be 1650 BC. That's 36 and a half centuries ago. Well, go back another 36 and a half centuries prior to 1650 BC. Do the arithmetic, you'll find that it's 5300 BC. So we could calculate that 5300 BC was about the time that this comet, this periodic comet, chronologically predictable, punctual, would have made its second previous approach to the sun, or loop around the sun, causing devastation on Earth, 5300 BC. And sure enough, the geologists Pittman and Ryan have shown from their studies of the Black Sea that the Black Sea was higher than it is today. There's great, they've done a lot of geological studies to show that it overflowed, the Black Sea overflowed around 5300 BC. There was great flooding catastrophe. And this is when the great flood of Noah's Day occurred. There's more geological evidence of 5300 BC showing that, again, the cycle, periodic interval of 36 and a half centuries separates each and every catastrophe that occurs on Earth. Now, we can go back one more time, one more 36 and a half century cycle prior to 5300 BC. And that would land us, if you do the arithmetic, go back 36 and a half centuries prior to 5300 BC, and you land on 9000 BC, the sinking of Atlantis. Studies, researchers believe, most of them believe that the sinking of Atlantis occurred around 9000 BC. It was extinction of the Clovis, what were called the Clovis people that lived, they believe they lived around 10,000 BC, and sometime later than 10,000 BC, more recent than 10,000 BC, they became extinct. And the extinction events that occurred would have certainly explained how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
No. So Atlantis was pretty much. Now, we got some information from the great Egyptian priests way back, many centuries ago, who spoke with the famous ancient philosopher Solon, or the law, he was called the great lawgiver of Greece, Solon, S-O-L-O-N. And Solon went to Egypt, and the Egyptian priest told him that we Egyptians are very meticulous about keeping historical records. And we can tell you that there was a great society, a great empire named called Atlantis that was destroyed by great catastrophes and floods, tidal waves, and earthquakes encircling, you know, devastating the entire earth. And Solon took that information and wrote it down, and they gave it to his to a second generation grandson, I believe, or some relative or someone, two generations following him, named Plato. Plato was a famous mathematician and a statesman in Greece. And Plato wrote two tracts. This is called the Critias and the Timaeus, in which he described, laid out everything that Solon had gathered from these Egyptian historians. And that's how we know about the sinking of Atlantis. And now they're beginning to find remains of it. Remains of Atlantis are being dredged up. James McCanney had stated this several years ago, that are being dredged up by the United States Navy off the northern coast of Australia. They're not telling people about it, but there is sunken Atlantis is being dredged up, and also they have discovered up 2,000 or 3,000 feet below the ocean, surface of the ocean, off the coast of Cuba, they found civilization submerged. Also, the Bimini Road, 40 miles off the coast of Florida.
Yeah, and you look at all these areas that are desert now that used to have oceans flowing in them, and I mean, you know, people don't, I guess they don't use the common sense and look at that and say, hey, you know, this has happened before. What caused it? And not even really the big deal about what caused it, but just the fact that it's happened before. And I don't know, people go around thinking that, well, that won't happen now because I'm here. That stuff right. can't well, happen to me.
Yeah, modern science has kept us in the dark about that. They don't want to accept it. Again, it's all political. It's all a matter of keeping the truth from the people. And they'll tell you that, oh, what happened with the ice ages? How did they tell you that it took thousands and thousands of years for ice to creep down from the North Pole to cause ice ages in the Americas?
Which is a lie.
Actually, the origin of the Great Lakes were ice, and great ice masses that existed. And scientists give us the false explanation that somehow ice just crept down magically over thousands and thousands of years from the North Pole. Well, how could that happen? There's no reason for it. When the sun is shining, the Earth is in a particular orbit, the sun is shining on the Earth such that we have the four seasons. We have summer, winter, and there's no way that ice is going to build up around the equator or around the temperate zone of the United States around the Great Lakes.
Yeah, just look at the woolly mammoth, you know, they found with the food still fresh in their bellies and even in their mouth. I mean, what does that tell you?
that is the most powerful piece of evidence to indicate that the Earth turned over in space in a matter of an hour or so. I mean, that is extremely powerful evidence. We can describe it, tell you what happened. In the Arctic region of Siberia, people discovered submerged mammoths. These woolly mammoths were much bigger than elephants. And they had huge curved tusks. They were discovered over the past century. I would say 40 or more of these woolly mammoths were discovered standing on their feet, submerged under tens of feet of ice that had built up since their death. They didn't even have time to lie down, crawl into a ball, try to stay warm. They were standing on their feet. They were flash frozen.
Yeah, I was going to say, evidence would show that they were flash frozen. I mean, it was in the blink of an eye.
Right, and they were chewing on tropical vegetation, which indicates that the Arctic region of Siberia was once a tropical zone because they had tropical vegetation in their mouths when they were dissected and tropical vegetation in their stomachs. And with 40 or more of the mammoths, that's irrefutable proof that this actually occurred. You know, you could try to explain it away with one mammoth as evidence, but when you have 40 or more, there's no way to falsify that fact. So what happened was that the Earth rotated vertically. Why would it rotate vertically? There must have been a gravitational pull on the Earth, abnormal to that of the Sun. The Sun is what keeps us Earth revolving horizontally. And, you know, even though there's an inclination of the Earth on its axis, and the Earth seems to, move in its annual revolution around the Sun, will rise above and below the equatorial plane of the Sun, which gives us the seasons, you know, cooling of the Earth during the winter time, because now the Sun is shining primarily on the southern hemisphere, and then in the summertime, the Sun is shining primarily on the northern hemisphere because of the Earth's, you know, angle, in its orbit, the angle of the Earth's rotational plane. Revolutionary plane on the Sun.
And John, one of our listeners. Oh, I'm sorry. I just wanted to tell you, one of our listeners also brought up the fact that palm trees were discovered in Alaska under ice.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've got to look that up. That's amazing. I mean, that you would probably expect that. When the Earth rotated, you know, what happened was Siberia happened to be in its rotation. I mean, remember, it's a daily Earth also, in addition to revolving around the Sun and making one revolution in 1 year, Earth also rotates once every 24 hours. So when that gravitational pull occurred due to this huge passing body that acted like a magnet pulling on the Earth and yanking it into a different rotational plane. When that happened, it could have been a time of day when the Siberian Arctic was originally in a tropical zone. Then it got rotated. The Earth got rotated vertically such that the Siberian tropical zone was rotated vertically towards the top of the Earth. And it became frozen. It became the frozen Arctic. At the same time, on the other side, on the opposite side of the Earth, the state of Wisconsin and the Great Lakes were somewhere around the North Pole. Wisconsin, Toronto, Canada, the Great Lakes, all that was around the North, was the North Pole at the time. That area got rotated downward into the temperate zone, closer to the equator. And what was then the North Pole became states of Wisconsin, the Great Lakes, and there you go. There's the vertical rotation of the Earth is explained in that way. And we could see, as you said, with the frozen mammoths, absolutely irrefutable proof of this remarkable global event.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and you see the signs for that type of thing now. I mean, on a small scale here, we were down to around 20 degrees here in Columbia, South Carolina, and then the next day it got up to 80, and that's a dramatic temperature change. But imagine, you know, what these woolly mammoths went through. I mean, they, 1 minute they're in the tropical sun eating some grass, and just a second later it's, you know, ice time, baby.
Yeah, right. You know, I'm glad you brought up about the temperature, drastic temperature changes. That reminds me that I've been following the Weather Channel ever since 2004, but now it's becoming this temperature, yo-yo-like temperature swings are becoming so extreme, so frequent now. On the Weather Channel, even the Weather Channel is, meteorologists are flipping out and surprised and amazed at these temperature swings. They said like 2 hours ago it was 70, we were in the 70s in some state, I forget which state it was, and then a couple hours later dropped down into the 30s from the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a matter of a few hours. And this has happened. I've got this recorded on videotape a number of times. It's happened. And it's happening more and more often. Now, I put out a, I believe I'm the only one in the world who has presented this particular theory, that I believe that the Earth's inner core, that is solid, what scientists believe to be a solid metal core at the very center of the Earth, sort of like a pit inside of an avocado, that core is no longer at the center. It's being pulled off center, and now that solid metal core is causing all of these huge undulations in the jet stream. And that's why we see the jet stream going down, going down like a sort of like a window shade of cold air from Canada and from the North Pole. That cold air is being yanked down roughly down as far south as Louisiana and Alabama and Florida. And then all of a sudden it comes back up like raising a window shade up and down. And the reason I speculate is, again, I think I'm the only one, I'm sure I'm the only one that's made the speculation. I put it out on the internet and sent it to many scientists, geologists, astrophysicists, and others, in addition to all the other people on my list, that in detail I've taken quite a bit of pains and effort to present the scientific basis for it. And it's quite lengthy and still not complete, but I put it out anyway every once in a while. I intend to issue it again, stating that the Earth's core, I believe the Earth's solid core, inner core, is off-center. You see, the Earth's inner core floats inside of a molten iron core, molten metal core, which is called the Earth's outer core. So it's like a, you know, a solid ball floating inside liquid, liquid envelope. And then beyond that liquid metal outer core of the Earth, and encircling that is the Earth's mantle, which is by far the thickest region of the Earth, like 1,800 miles thick, I think it is. And that's molten rock and metals mixed, etc. Sort of like really thick. It's called magma, of course, and it's sort of like a thick pudding like material.
Might that explain, possibly be an explanation to these massive sinkholes that we're experiencing everywhere, and even this sound that people hear, like it almost sounds like the crust is moving, like there's a locomotive slamming its brakes on underground.
Yeah. I agree. I think these mantle plumes. They're called mantle plumes, and also they're called thermal plumes, and also another name is magma plumes. But you're right. They are related. I believe they're related to sinkholes and related to the volcanic eruptions and islands that we're seeing. Here's what happens again, and again. I studied this, and from what I've done some reading and then some theorizing, which is, I believe, logical theorizing, indicating that the Earth's inner core is getting, the inner solid core is off-center. There's a lot of friction due to the displacement of the Earth's center solid core within that liquid outer core. And because of displacement, the friction is becoming very great. And now the Earth's molten iron core is increasing in temperature. And when it does that, based upon some of the readings that I've done, when it goes through periods of heating and cooling, temperature rises, again, molten outer core. And when it does that, some of the mantle begins to dissolve away. You can imagine that happening when you're cooking something. You know, have some food in a pot and you turn the heat up. Whatever was solid on the top begins to melt, thin out a little bit because of the the added heat that's being put into it. Well, that's what's happening, the heat friction. And I don't only the heat of friction, but the electromagnetic energy that's being blasted and transmitted through and coupled into the Earth's core from the Earth's magnetic field. And that is becoming originating from the sun. That energy blasting from the sun is solar winds, electrified particles, which are creating electrified particles in motion, waves of them in motion. We know it's a basic tenet of physics that electrified particles like electrons and protons that are being blasted out by the sun, when they're in motion, they create electromagnetic fields surrounding the path of their travel. And those electromagnetic fields impact the Earth's magnetic field. And this, it creates a jousting effect, electromagnetic solar jousting with Earth's magnetic field lines surrounding the Earth. Now, that couples back in, just like an electrical transformer would, the electromagnetic field couples back in toward the center of the Earth. So any electromagnetic induction that occurs to Earth's outer magnetic field, way, way out into space, is coupled back into Earth through the magnetic field lines, which are formed like sort of like the core of an apple. You see, you notice how the skin of the apple dimples inward toward the top of the apple and seems to lead right into the core. Well, that's how these electromagnetic lines of the Earth's magnetic field travel also, and it's coupled back to the core. That's causing the inner core and solid metal inner core of the Earth and its molten metal outer core of the Earth to heat up. It's another reason for the heating. So now you have, and this magnetic field is what's pulling, yet magnetically yanking the Earth's inner core back to the center point because of the Earth. Now, the Earth's core now, instead of revolving smoothly at the center of the Earth, that solid metal inner core is sort of wobbling around inside the molten metal outer core. And that wobbling effect is what's causing the sloshing of the outer core, which in turn causes the sloshing or waviness of the jet stream, which is being pulled down. The effect of the jet stream is it's like a window shade coming up and down, whole air being pulled down from the Arctic down to Louisiana, then coming back up, and then now you have it following this cold wave from the north front of cold being blasted down or pulled down to Louisiana and Alabama. Following that, you have the window shade of cold air being pulled up again. It's a huge wave, and the results in heat waves in Minnesota and in Canada. So you see where, and this is exactly what's been going on. One period, maybe a week of a heat wave in the north, and then a cold wave in the south. Alternately back and forth because of this wave into the jet stream caused by sloshing around of the Earth's inner core within the molten matter. That's my theory. I presented that, and I'm planning to post it again to get the attention of as many scientists as I possibly can. But getting back onto the thing about Planet X, we have chronologically indexed two previous passages of Planet X on its orbital, chronologically punctual orbit, like a bus, sort of like a bus making a routine travel. You know, you can predict what time the bus is going to come, because there's a schedule. Well, this, we've seen 1650 BC was a passage that caused great destruction. The ancient legends of the Mayans and the Mexicans and the Chinese, records of the Emperor Daozhu, during the time of 1650 BC, all speak, record records of great catastrophes that occurred, floods, hurricanes, tremendous storms, windstorms that are many hundreds of miles per hour, and a stopping of the Earth in its rotation such that there was three or more days of sunlight in China, while on the other side of the Earth, there was 3 or 4 days of darkness. and scared the hell out of everyone, of course, of the civilizations in the Americas, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Incas in Peru spoke of this, or their ancient legends talked about 3 days of darkness, and the Bible itself tells us about these catastrophic earthly events. The parting of the Red Sea occurred at this time, around 3650 BC, when the Israelites were liberated from bondage under the Pharaoh in Egypt, and they crossed the Red Sea, actually parted. That was a rotation of the earth. The earth rotated vertically, nodded vertically, causing great windstorms. And a comet, well, again, this is my theory too, a comet came by. The comet came close enough. It's recorded in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, when the Israelites fled. There was a beam of, called it an angel, beam of light that guided the Israelites. And then there was a beam of darkness, a cloud, that separated the Israelites from the pursuing Egyptian army, so that the Egyptians could not see their people that they were pursuing when they reached, these people, the Israelites, reached the shores of the Red Sea. And my theory is that what happened was a comet came close enough to cause an electrical discharge, because they are electrically engulfed with plasma. We know that comets, and comet I saw, proved to be electrically engulfed with plasma, so much so that it caused, its plasma was discharged to Mars, and James McCanney, and even the photographs show that Mars momentarily, for a period of time, became cometary with a coma, the glowing coma around it, the green light. Well, this comet, back in ancient times when the Israelites were fleeing Egypt, got close enough to Earth that it caused a discharge electrically to bring the light angel, that they called it, to protect the Israelites, to give them sight. But at the same time, the gravitational force of this very approaching comet was so, because of its close proximity to Earth, it was strong enough to pull up on a land bridge which crossed the Red Sea, pulling this land bridge upward, and then comet moved away, the land bridge collapsed very abruptly, sort of like if you were to take a bathtub or a child's swimming pool and take a big, huge 2x4 maybe, or a long, maybe a log would be a better way to explain. Take a log and drop the log into the pool and then lift it up again. But when you drop it in there, of course, the water is separated. And both sides of separating water travel away from one another. And that's what happened when this land bridge collapsed. The water came, basically, the two separated bodies of water butted heads, more or less. And the impact caused each, the reaction force caused each of the two bodies of separated water to reverse, to travel away from one another for a period of time. Because it's such a large mass, the period of time lasted for hours. When the two bodies were separated, because they had collided, and the reaction force separated them from one another, creating an absence of water, a pathway. And the Bible states that the seabed was actually dry. People could walk on the seabed, and that's how millions of 3 million Israelites walked across this seabed. And the Bible even states that there was columns of water, huge walls of water on both sides. So they did not refer to a land bridge like many theorists would tell you. You say, oh, it was a land bridge that you walked across. Well, with a land bridge, you wouldn't have a huge wall of water on each side of you. That's what the Bible states, and that the wall of water will be explained by the two separated bodies of water. If you ever see a tsunami, what happens before a tsunami occurs, there is a drawback. And that's what happened in Asia. when the big tsunami of Christmas 2004 occurred. Are you there, Michael?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You remember what happened. There was a huge, people were, didn't even expect a tsunami. They had no idea that this great catastrophe was about to come upon them.
No, the water backed off, and people were walking up and thinking, oh, that's amazing. They had no idea what was happening.
Right. They said, wow, look at all the fish that are floating on the seabed. They were grabbing fish and not realizing that something strange and possibly dangerous was occurring. Well, that's what happened. You had a double drawback, I believe. And that caused the Red Sea to part. Now, what that tells you is that the Bible is not just myth, but actual scientific fact. And it happened. The scientific fact was that comets came by. And the scientific fact was that the Earth actually exhibited a pole shift, where it rotated vertically. And because of the pole shift, it now, here's the funny thing. According to God, knew how he was going to do this pole shift, and just when it was going to happen. When the Earth rotates, take a basketball and hold it between the index finger of both your hands. Can you imagine that? Sideways. You put the index finger of one hand, the index finger of the other hand, and just hold the sides of the basketball that way.
Yeah.
Now have someone rotate that basketball vertically. Can you visualize that?
Oh, I can.
Okay. Now when they rotate it, where your fingers are is a pivot point. That doesn't move. The top of the basketball rotates, you know, and goes downward. The bottom of the basketball rotates upward, but the point where your fingers are located really doesn't rotate at all. It just pivots. And that's where Egypt was. That's where the Red Sea was, the pivot point, where your two finger, index fingers would be holding, creating an axis of rotation for the basketball, for the Earth. And that's what happened. It pivoted, and that caused these tremendous winds for the Bible that lasted for hours and hours. But again, comet, the rotational force kept those people. I still have to iron out a lot of this theory because it's pretty complicated. But I'm pretty sure that was the pivot point if you look at the Earth.
Okay.
Considering that, where was the point that actually did the major rotation? Well, that was Wisconsin, Toronto, Canada, the Great Lakes. That was the North Pole at the time. That portion of the Earth rotated vertically downward into the temperate zone. It became warm, and that big ice sheet melted and became the Great Lakes. At the same time, the other side of the Earth, the tropical zone of Siberia, with the Mat Woolen Mammoths eating tropical flowers, that rotated northward and froze and became the Arctic region.
That's right. And so, John, we're getting down to about the last 7-8 minutes, and I know you wanted to get into what people can do to prep, and boy, the time just flies. But you know, if you wouldn't mind, I don't know if you have the capabilities, so I'm sure you probably do, but maybe sometime later in the week you and I could do an actual video interview and go through all this, and I could actually put up graphics of what we're talking about.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Something along those lines. All right, well, I'll be in touch so we could set that up. But you might want to get into some of the prepping, what people can do to protect themselves from this. And, wow, again, the time just flew by.
Yeah. Well, what you do is, the best way to prep, I think, is a great visual vehicle would be for everybody to please make a mental note of this. Go to YouTube and look for, write this down, National Geographic. It's called NatGeoTV, NatGeoTV. It's National Geographic Television. They recently did a documentary, a docudrama, titled American Blackout. So just go to YouTube and type in American Blackout, NatGeoTV, National Geographic, whatever, and you can find the entire, it was a 2-hour thing with commercials, so the commercials are out of it. It lasts about an hour and a half. And watch the whole thing. It's just horrifying. It's so realistic. It shows people and they seem like everyday people with their cell phones recording what they went through, horrible events that they went through when there was a blackout. And the blackout lasted for only 10 days, but after 10 days, people were killing each other for food and for water. And you see all the details of what happens, how people are stuck in elevators, how people were trying to buy a gallon of water for $40 with a credit card, you know, it's useless, you know, because credit cards are worthless.
Yeah.
And you see people, neighbors coming to try to steal food from other neighbors. Some people were prepared. They had food stored. They had water. And if you watch that, that's a very sobering presentation they're describing, revealing to us what we must do to protect ourselves. Well, to survive and protect ourselves during such an event. Just a loss of electricity without a hurricane, without an earthquake, without any natural disaster, just the loss of electricity that comes from the sun, and that could happen next week. Who knows, a week, 2 weeks from now, a month from now. They say next week, a week from today, is about the 28th.
Yeah.
There's going to be a close proximity of ISON or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, Thanksgiving.
I don't know my dates very much, but ISON caused the sun to put out such a blast that it will knock out the power grids. Mm. And scientists are telling us that. That's not a speculation. They are telling us that. Yeah, so sun emits very great coronal mass ejections and flares directly toward Earth. It'll not electrically fry the power grid. And the proof is that it happened already in the year 1859, when there was what was called the Carrington event, when the sun put out tremendous solar electrical emissions and fried all the telegraph lines. At that time, it was not catastrophic because telegraph lines were not the essence of our lives. But now, computers and power lines are the essence of our lives. Without them, we can't do anything. We don't know how to farm. We don't know how to garden. We're not individuals anymore. We're part of a collective mass that depends upon supermarkets.
Right.
To survive. So, this next event, the next Carrington event, which was proven to have occurred in 1859, so no one can say, oh, that's just a guess. No, it's happened before. That's about to occur again with this hyperactive sun being excited by the comets, which are electrical, two electrical bodies, each one of different polarity. Comets are positive plasma, engulfed in positive plasma. And the sun is primarily, mostly electrons, space charge, surrounding the sun. When the positive and the negative charges get close enough, you know what happens. They attract one another.
Yeah.
And that's what we call electrical lightning bolts toward the sun, causing the sun to flare out because of this electrical excitation. And there goes your power grid, there goes power. And they tell us, this is what they're telling us now, that when those transformers are destroyed by solar winds, coronal mass ejections, the transformers cost millions of dollars, they're about the size of a house, and they're made only in China, and it takes about 3 years to order one, to get one. Forget it.
Yeah.
I mean, when the power gets knocked out, China won't be able to produce anything, because China won't have any power either.
Yeah, but it'll be back to the candlelight and kerosene lamps. I hope people have some storage.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. There's a candelier lantern, which I really recommend. I have several of them. They make a single candle lantern and a triple candle lantern. It's fireproof. You can knock it over. There won't be any fires. In this National Geographic, a very realistic docudrama, they describe house fires occurring in many places because people needed light, needed heat, they lit candles, and the houses caught on fire. You can expect that. But with a candle lantern, you could knock it over and it will not start a fire. It's got windows all around it. And the candles are spring-loaded. They're bullet-shaped, and they're held in place by a bullet-shaped spring-loaded candle holder. So as the candle burns down, the does exert more upward force, such that the lowering flame of the candle is counterbalanced by the upward push on the candle by the spring, and consequently, the flame of the candle remains at the same height in the window, in its window, three windows on the candle lantern, and on top of the lantern is a hot plate, where you can put a cup of coffee or soup or whatever to warm it up. And those candles, I was told by people who use them, really get put out a lot of heat.
So oh, that's neat.
Winter time, you could heat a small room substantially with a triple candle lantern.
See, I wish companies like that need to have an affiliates program so we can put stuff like that up on the site. And, of course, then you get accused of, oh, you're talking about this because you're trying to sell stuff, but that's not the truth.
Oh, no, they would know. They would be desperate to get what you're selling when the time occurs. But the company, people should write this down. UCO is the name of the company. The letters UCO. And the name of the candle is Candelier. Take the word candle, C-A-N-D-L-E, and add the letters L-I-E-R. Just remember, UCO is a company, and Candelier is the name of the lantern. Buy them. I've got several of them. Camping stores like Campmore, you can buy the refill candles. You have to buy the special candles that fit in there. I've got boxes of them, but those candle refills for my Candelier lantern.
Yeah, well,
that's something that people ought to get immediately.
Well, John, we're about at the end here, but we'll definitely when we do this video, we'll make sure we get everything in. I love talking to you. You know, you're real. You just put it out there as you see it, and I appreciate that. And you know, I want to have you back again in the near future. Not to mention, do a video so people can see what we're talking about. I think that would be great. But John, anything you'd like to get out there before we finish? I know you do a radio show, don't you?
Yeah, it's pre-recorded. It's a drama. I feel that people could know about Planet X if they're dramatically attracted to it. Everybody's excited by a mysterious drama with music, background music, and all that. And people, documentary spokesman, speaking on it, and it becomes entertaining, and as a result they will be attracted to a subject which would normally be repulsive to them, the concept of Earth going through great destruction. So rather than fleeing from it, I gave them something that would attract them. It's called Planet X and Bible Prophecy. It's on shortwave radio. It's also on the internet.
Okay.
So
all right. Well, John, thank you so much for taking time out to be with us. I always enjoy having you on. Despite what we're talking about, people need to know the truth, and that's what we're trying to do, just get the truth out there. So thank you, John.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm so happy to be able to communicate with your audience. Thank you, Michael.
All right, John, you have a good night, and I will be in touch most definitely tomorrow, and we can plan on doing a video of some sort in the very near future. So thank you, John DiNardo. Again, I've got links on the website for John, and he's got a radio show that he does. It's on shortwave. If you have shortwave, you might want to tune into that. And with that, folks, I thank you all for joining us here tonight on Late Night in the Midlands. And tomorrow night, we've got Robert Sullivan, The Royal Ark of Enoch will be the topic. And with that, folks, keep your eyes posted to the sky because you never know what you might see. And keep your ears posted to this broadcast because you never know what you might learn. Good night, everybody.